Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Jose De Jesus, CTO of Automation for Expert Labs at IBM. Good morning, Jose.
Good morning, Fred. Thank you for having me here. It's an honor.
Great. Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we would appreciate if you would take just a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Jose. So Jose, why don't you get us started by telling us a bit about yourself and your purview at IBM?
Sure. So I was born and raised in New York. I went to Fordham University for my undergraduate degree in computer science, and then later did a master's in Miami at the University of Miami in management of technology. I would classify myself as a happy geek. I graduated from college from Fordham at 19 because I was lucky enough to start early.
That's impressive.
Thank you. And then I've always loved science. I got heavily involved with computers during high school. I competed in science fairs. I won first place twice in a row. And then during my senior year, I won a school-wide logic contest at a different school too. So I was also very social, but basically a geek.
That's a nice combination.
Yeah, it is. So I enjoy spending time with my family, friends, working out, reading books, learning languages, listening to good music, and watching a good movie every once in a while. So at IBM, that's personal about me. Now at IBM, I'm the CTO of Automation for Expert Labs. I've been in the industry for about 30 years. I'm a certified executive architect, and I've had roles ranging from delivery lead for the Americas of the Garage Expert Labs, chief architect for IBM software adoption, a cloud expert and certification lead, a senior software engineer, robotic specialist, and so forth. I even did OS2 kernel debugging, if any one of our listeners remembers what OS2 is.
I don't.
my responsibilities include just overseeing, Expert Labs' overall mission, automation mission, and their strategic goals, as well as overseeing the development and the dissemination of technologies and any reusable assets that can help our clients reach what we call straight through processing.
So I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this are thinking about this. What is Expert Labs? Could you maybe drill deeper into that?
Sure. Expert Labs is a team within IBM that's considered kind of the creme of the creme. So when clients go out and we have a services team helping the client and they bump into problems or issues, technical issues or, architectural issues that need, further help on IBM, that's where Expert Labs comes in.
Okay.
And we provide, experts within our team that are masters of the product, SMEs of a particular product or particular, best practice or architecture and so forth to provide the help.
For a company as large as IBM, collaboration among teams is crucial in order to keep achieving the high levels of success that people have come to expect from IBM. Mm-hmm. How do you ensure effective communication among large teams so that information sharing is effective and silos are not developed?
So this is a good question. This is an interesting question. As you know, right, the COVID-19, the global pandemic, just brought a deeper focus on more effective communication. So companies said, look, we have to, things are remote now. We need to start embracing remote work and communicate effectively. And the reality is that the impact of how COVID to how we work at IBM was minimum, because in many areas, we've been effectively communicating and working remotely for years, way before the pandemic. So we have a lot of experience in that area. And so when I think about it, ensuring effective communication and collaboration, I would say there are three fundamental areas. Tools and technology, you need the right tools, uh-huh. Engagement, and then the approach and the agenda of how you communicate. So One, tools and technology. You got to make sure you have the right up-to-date tools, whether it's Zoom, Slack, tools for video conferencing, online collaboration software, et cetera, et cetera. I just gave you some examples there, but yeah, you have to have the right tools in place. Also, making sure you keep those teams engaged, right? Which doing so virtually could be difficult, as you know. So yeah, creating chat spaces for people who may not be able to feel as comfortable speaking out loud in meetings, in virtual meetings specifically, right? So creating a way of engaging people. And then finally, you have the approach and the agenda, which is also important, right? When you're working virtually, a lot of things can kind of slip and you're not realizing you're hurting the communication rather than helping. So not everything needs to be decided in a meeting, for example. Email is still very effective. Mm-hmm. But when a meeting is needed, make sure you have a clear agenda. You know, the discussion points to focus on the conversation, the follow-up for next steps. Also, respecting people's time is important. As you know, meetings always sometimes go over, but those should be the exceptions, not the norm. You should try to stick to that allotted time. So, and finally, one thing that regarding approach, one thing I like to do whenever I start a new project, right, is I make sure that the team gets to know each other well, even if it's virtual, and start thinking as one team with a common goal. So that communication, that collaboration is an essential part of it. Leaders play a key role in this, right, in establishing the tone of that communication and the level of tension and productivity or lack thereof that may ensue, right? You got to get the team to be working as one to gain their trust, because the minute people start thinking of just, oh, I got to guard my fort and I got to protect myself, then that communication and collaboration starts to break down. And when it's virtual, it's a lot easier for that to break down, and therefore productivity would suffer. So that would be...
You mentioned that you like to make sure that, you know, people know each other before you get going, even if it's a meeting or and so on and so forth. Do you guys do any team building activities virtually? Is there anything that you guys do that's unique to your team or within IBM?
Absolutely. Well, I don't think it's what we do is probably not unique to IBM. Other companies mm-hmm. are probably doing the same, but we do in-person activities wherever possible. But in the case of when COVID hit, right, we really couldn't do in-person. So we do virtual, you know, get to know each other, virtual meetings. Also, in the beginning of some meetings, it's okay to spend a few minutes, right, getting to know the team. So one thing I did, let me give you a quick example here. So I was once leading a global project with a team of over 120 consultants, uh-huh. right? And they were spread across different parts of the US, the UK, and India. And so the client initially, because this came from a previously failed project with another consulting company, the client was very defensive and so forth. So by establishing this, hey, we either swim or sink together, and creating these activities that you're referring to and getting to know each other better. And even when we realized that some of their team members needed to sharpen their skills in some areas, you know, rather than broadcast it to executives as a safety net for us saying, oh, you know, that's because of your team and finger pointing, uh-huh. we provided guidance. And then that created that trust. That ROI we got in return was trust, right? These same members were now part of really one team with us, and we were able to make that work and make that quite fun. Till this day, that project was, you know, a few years ago. Until this day, we still keep in touch. We still all, you know, remain communicating with each other because we basically became friends. So that's important as part of that communication and collaboration within the team.
Right. Yeah, and that is a true testament to how you led the team, because if years on, you guys still keep in touch, even though you're now working on that same project together, just goes to show you the strong bonds that you guys built while doing that. So that's impressive. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you. Yeah, even with the client, which is good, I think. You know, so when I say the team, I really mean the one team, both IBM
collectively.
And yeah.
Yep. Large companies sometimes acquire competitors and integrate them into their own operations. What recommendations do you have for leaders who oversee such acquisitions whereby the acquired company is using different technology platforms to your own? You know, how do you build that harmony so that you eliminate technical debt?
Yeah, another good question. So we at IBM have been pretty acquisitive, right? In the last 30 years, IBM has acquired over 200 companies, right? This year alone, we've acquired 7 companies, having invested more than $1 billion in the first 9 months of the year. to add new capabilities in areas like hybrid cloud services, security, data, observability, and sustainability, and so forth. Since April of 2020, we've acquired more than 25 companies to bolster our hybrid cloud and AI capabilities. Uh-huh. But for us, it's not about the size of the acquisition. It's about the strategic fit, right? And how to capture growing opportunities around cloud, data, and AI, which is our laser focus emphasis here. So, you know, we look for acquisitions that are going to help IBM strategy and contribute to IBM's growth in data, AI, security, automation, as you know, hybrid, and multi-cloud services. Now, there's a strategic fit, right, as I mentioned, but there's also an organizational fit between the two companies, which may be what you're mostly referring to here, right?
Right.
So we want to make sure that, you know, the corporate cultures match as much as possible, that the acquired company, members of the acquired companies feel welcome, right, feel that they can assimilate, assimilate into the new company easily. That we provide career and certification roadmaps so that they don't feel that, oh, you know, I was acquired by this company and now I got to start from scratch, or I got to, you know, be, I'm going to be left in a silo here while others advance in their career. So those things are important, right? And also other considerations such as, you know, don't rush into closing the acquisition without first resolving any ambiguities, right, between the two companies. Or understanding well the integration point and how the acquired company is going to contribute to IBM's growth and so forth. Because if you leave those things unchecked, you know, that's going to create a huge technical debt and eventually lead to failure.
So it's important to do that pre-work before the acquisition closes.
Absolutely. And I think throughout the years, IBM has done a pretty good job with this. I mean, it has a lot of experience with, again, acquiring over 200 companies in the last 30 years. And one thing I noticed from experience is that we don't rush into blue washing. Blue washing is a term we use in IBM for IBM branding. Uh-huh. We don't rush into blue washing an acquired company's portfolio, right? We kind of let them be, right? Especially if the software complements our offerings, but also stands on its own within our strategic goals, obviously. But and that has helped a lot, I think. So when we acquired Red Hat, for example, Red Hat is kind of its own separate entity, right, in many ways. So we don't, we kind of let them be and excel at what they're good at.
Organizations have access to a lot of data these days, which they in turn use to make strategic decisions. In what ways can they set themselves up to allow them to efficiently leverage AI without applying any biasness or over-reliance on data? Please share any examples that you may have on this.
Yeah, very good. So in my conversations with clients of all sizes across industries around the world, a clear theme continues to emerge. They need to completely digitize and automate their business workflows and IT processes, right? What I referred to earlier is straight through processing as much as possible. And they need to do that quickly, right? If they don't want to fall behind, they need to act fast. Now, they're all facing an array of, you know, real world challenges that are getting in the way of doing this quickly, right? You know, from regulatory and compliance landscape situations to inflation, shifts in demographics, talent shortages, supply chain bottlenecks, sustainability efforts, and so much more, right? So you have, they have these challenges ahead of them. So what businesses need to do to overcome these obstacles, right, is, you know, what do they need to do, right? What's the question that they need to do? One thing is, one of the main focuses toward that journey of digitization and automation is data, right? You must begin with the data, right? Data is really the fuel, right, for the business transformation, you know, so kind of the bloodline, right? Because it's critical, right, for extracting insights. And from there, being able to automate and applying, you know, AI and so forth. But the complexity of the format of the data, where it sits and so forth, you know, creates a problem, right? So, you know, what is IBM doing in this area, right? It's providing, you know, the processes, the technology, the people to make sure, you know, to overcome some of these challenges, right? The complexity, the data sprawl. We're helping businesses put the right governance and the guardrails in place to ensure that they can get the right data in the right hands at the right time, right? Without, of course, jeopardizing privacy, security, and compliance. Biases is a key thing, right? IBM has, you know, products such as OpenScale and others that, you know, ensure and validate that models are not based on biases or that are not driven by biases, which again is very important, right, in AI.
And especially for leaders, if they're looking at data, you want to look at it, you know, even if it's AI generated, give it some context. Don't fully rely on it, correct?
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And then another important point here is that, and IBM has been really good at this and from the very beginning, right, is you want to make sure that AI is augmenting, not replacing human intelligence, right?
Yes.
Because we're nowhere near where, you know, AI is on its own, right?
No, they can't just let alone to be running independently.
Exactly, exactly. So it needs to augment, not replace human intelligence, but it also needs, back to your point, it needs to be transparent and explainable. And of course, free of any harmful or inappropriate biases. So let me give you an example, right? So AI will never replace doctors, for example. It's going to be a combination of AI and human doctors.
Right.
So that combination is where you get the benefits.
Let's talk about the IBM Academy of Technology, of which you are a member. What is it and what role does it play within IBM?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah, I'm very fond of the Academy of Technology. It's a community of volunteers, right? Volunteer IBMers that was founded in 1989 as a community of top IBM talent to provide innovation, technical advice, and critiques, as well as help shape the technical underpinnings of IBM's future. So we talk about, you know, where IBM is, you know, where can we go from here? What technologies in the future may, you know, kind of pull the rug from under us, under our cash cows? What's going on so that we can start, you know, thinking ahead of the curve, ahead of time, and also innovation, so forth. The Academy of Technology was modeled after the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and Engineering. Uh-huh. And, you know, we have a lot of fun at the Academy. We carry out a lot of strategic initiatives, innovative ideas. I've led a couple of those ideas. And quite frankly, I'm honored to be a member.
And is this something that's only within IBM, so non-IBMers cannot be a part of this?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know any.
Just asking because I'm sure people will be thinking about that as they listen to this episode.
Yeah, it's treated as a separate entity from IBM, okay. But I'm not sure at this point. I'll have to get back to you on whether it's it accepts non-IBM members.
Okay, good.
Or honorary members. But the members are, you know, IBM fellows, IBM DEs, IBM, you know, and then other folks, you know, CTOs, directors. It can be anyone within IBM. I'm not sure if it accepts non-IBMers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Organizations have embarked on aggressive digital transformation projects to help them build a competitive edge in their own industries. What best practices would you recommend to help such organizations build a fully integrated technology stack without making mistakes that come with a poorly executed transformation strategy?
Very good. Another good question. So I said before that starting with data, right, is at the heart of business transformation, right? Understanding that data, getting those insights. But you also have some key fundamental things, right, that should be in place as precursors, if you may, right, to mm-hmm. becoming an autonomous digital enterprise. For example, companies need to have an API-led strategy, right, that would support their full, you know, API management lifecycle. The use of process and task mining is also an essential starting point for business processes. So process mining involves, you know, analyzing logs to be able to derive existing processes, correlating and figuring out what those processes are. And we have products and technologies that allow you to do that, where it basically analyzes your logs and says, hey, this is what your process is. Do you wish to improve it? You can compare new with old processing and so forth. Task mining is another thing where, you know, you capture user interaction to identify bottlenecks in the flow of things. So all these things put together, right, definitely help, right? Organizations come to that point where now they're turning their data into insights. And then those insights into actionable items with AI and automation. So that's kind of the holy grail when it comes to digital transformation, right? So as a result, we're seeing, you know, several use cases emerge, right? you know, if you look at the pressure that these companies are having into, you know, embarking on a journey of digital transformation, mm-hmm. straight processing and so forth, as I mentioned, you'll see that, and you know, this is in every aspect of business, right? From line of business like HR, sales, marketing, and finance to IT operations, right? AI ops. And we have you know, technologies for each of these areas. So we see several use cases emerging, right? One is, you know, AI to automate IT processes, right? As you know, downtime can cause a business a lot of money and hurt their reputation big time. Yep. So, you know, we have technology for that, right? For addressing AI ops, proactively catching problems before they occur by injecting AI, you know, AI models and analyzing, correlating data so that, you know, the system is able to tell you, look, you may have a downtime unless you increase this memory or unless you do this because this happened, you know, a month before. This is how you resolved it. All sorts of really smart technology there mm-hmm. that can let you minimize downtime or eliminate it altogether by predicting that downtime before it even happens, which is something, you know, an SRE and other engineers won't be able to detect, right, manually. There's just way too much information coming in that needs to be analyzed, correlated, and so forth, and applied, and AI applied to. So that's one, IT, automating IT processes, automating business workflows, right? Such as, you know, HR, supply chains, financial reporting. So as I was saying earlier, you know, automating any sort of repetitive tasks, you know, whether it's through RPA or other means, so that you're freeing up employees to do higher value work. And you're not having employees just do, you know, repetitive tasks.
Repetitive tasks that don't require, you know, human intelligence.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, I want to ask you something that you mentioned earlier when you started responding to this question about API lifecycle. I've seen companies have open APIs. I've seen companies have private APIs. What are the pros and cons of each? What would you recommend as a leader of a global company like IBM? What would be the best strategy for a company that's trying to adopt the use of APIs? Should they keep them open? Should they privatize them? You know, what's your recommendation on that?
So open API, so either way, right? A company should have very clearly defined APIs, right? For even if these are not public APIs, even though they're private, even if they were private APIs for their developers to, you know, create applications within the enterprise, those APIs still need to be clearly defined. There should not be anything that's not, you know, fully documented, whether they use Swagger or whatever it is that they use. That part needs to always be open, if you may, quote unquote, needs to be very clearly spelled out. Nothing should be hidden in that sense. Now, the policy of whether some APIs are going to be open and closed, that's really up to the company, depending on what their strategy is, right? They may have some APIs that they want to open to external developers or external, you know, or other partners. And there may be some API that are strictly for internal use only. But the important thing about all that, right, when you have an API-led strategy is that everything really has to be very clearly documented, very clearly and published and made available through portals and so forth. And again, we do have technologies that allow that. We were, in fact, and Gartner identified us as a leader in that API-led API lifecycle management.
That's wonderful. Good to know. All right. This is my last question and one of my favorite questions to ask all the guests that I have on the Ivy podcast. What has helped you get to where you are? And what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's identical to yours?
Oh, nice. Okay. So first and foremost, I would say passion for the field, right? Wanting to transform the world, wanting to, you know, just loving the field. In my case, right, I've always loved technology, innovation, and thinking out of the box. That's a blessing and a curse sometimes. Sometimes, you know, I want to think out of the box when a best practice has been very well established and works very well, but I still want to see, is there some other way of doing it? I don't know. So it's a mix. But yeah, but definitely be passionate about it, right? So if you're passionate about automation, for example, or any other technology, then read as many books as you can, articles, blogs, anything you can find on the subject, talk to experts, share your knowledge with others. In other words, soak yourself in that topic. And then my second piece of advice is, right, you can't do everything all the time, right? So come up with your long-term plan of where you want to be in, say, even the next year, the next 3 years, 5 years. set your goals and keep them visible. Keep them either post-it notes somewhere, keep them in a nice elaborate plan. My family always criticizes because I laminate my plans. I put a plan on a sheet, I laminate it.
Wow, and a technology guy using hard copies.
Hard copies, I do that. I do that. I keep it visible. And then also manage your time carefully, right? Some things you will inevitably have to drop or postpone, right? So lay them all out and decide which ones you want to pursue first. Because remember, you have to live. You have to enjoy your family, friends, pursue your hobbies. You still have to have a life, right? So one thing that to me has particularly helped me has been time boxing, right? Just as a way to manage my time. I wrote an article on Medium on that, in case anyone's interested, called Time Boxing for Resilience. But basically, it just consists of allotting a fixed time for certain tasks and then keeping track of progress. Other time management techniques work better for other people. Just find the one that best fits the way you work. Finally, look for mentors. I've been fortunate enough to have great guidance from great people. They have been instrumental to my career, IBM fellows, DEs, and so forth. And then also give that back. That's going to be extremely important, right? You'll realize that as you're teaching others and you're giving back, you're growing yourself, right? And I'll leave you with this final quote from one of my favorite quotes from a book called The Leader's Legacy. It says, and it's embedded in my mind, it says, in the end, it's not about what you achieve for yourself, but what you achieve for others. Not how big a campfire you build, but how well you kept others warm.
Wonderful. Appreciate you taking your time to talk to us today, Jose.
Sure. Thank you, Fred. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.